I'm always glad to get an opportunity to speak when people have to give an introduction, because that's generally the only time I hear anything really exaggerated and nice. It is almost unnecessary to state, extremely honored to be invited to speak on this series. I am moreover almost shocked to see the large number of those that are here. And then I realized why there was such a large number when I noticed the poster on my way over, because it had a picture of someone that seems like they had two heads. And I'm sure there was a manifest curiosity to see if I could live up to that billing. Now, I'm asked to speak on the black man in the law. Now, this is an excellent title, because it's so ambiguous that most anything I speak of which bears the slightest relationship either to the need or the number of or the competence and status of blacks in the law is relevant. It smacks both of the hortatory and the informational. Now, it may well be that the role of the black in law is closely related to the status of blacks in the general community. And thus, it is particularly appropriate that we discuss this matter at this time, because the nation is now facing a crisis in race relations. At another period, I had stated that many black citizens trapped in the decaying slums of American citizens have become frustrated, bitter, and cynical, with no faith in the morality or promises of white America and its institutions. They've been buffeted by employers and by unions, and lied about by politicians, that their patience has long since been exhausted, many of them, their hopes turned to despair, their trust corroded to hate, and these, the inhabitants of the vermin-infested, vice-ridden core of the urban communities, can see nothing but continued repression and discrimination, and that many of them long for black enclaves where they may suffer in peace with other blacks. Now, while I spoke before, the cynicism and disillusionment of the ghetto black, it's clear that this bitterness has become increasingly evident in the smaller towns and the rural areas. Riots in the Delta region of Arkansas and Georgia are symptomatic of this unrest. Lack of employment and unemployment, discrimination in the administration of government programs, together with a seeming lack of concern by the state agencies in economic plight, which gets steadily worse, has resulted in an acceleration over the last 6 months. This has been especially true where there's a substantial black population, but no black elected officials. gerrymandering to dilute black political power, the harassment of black voters, discrimination in the location of polling places spells out a situation which causes little optimism that the Negro can use politics to solve the American problem. Now, even in those places where there's a measure of political power and freedom to vote, the attitudes of the citizen majority many times precludes the establishment or advancement of a just society. How can you, save on grounds of dedication of a substantial number of Cook County citizens, explain the renomination of a state's attorney under indictment for the most flagrant and disgraceful conduct? Conspiracy to pervert justice, save on the grounds that that conduct is okay as long as the victims are black. How can you explain the cowardly capitulation of almost all major candidates in the last primary in Florida to the racist theory of a George Wallace under the code name of busing and law and order? As my good friend Don Hollowell, the well-known black lawyer from Atlanta, stated, law and order has always been anathema to the black persons. In the days of legal segregation, the law was for the blacks who got ordered around. And many don't believe in the law, which says there shall be no discrimination in employment based on race, color, religion, national origin, or sex. But they do believe in law and order when it's calculated to serve as a barrier to blacks and other minorities who seek citizenship rights or the protection of rights they supposedly already have. They don't believe in law when the Supreme Court of the United States says public schools which are segregated are inherently unequal and orders them desegregated. Indeed, such men, and I speak generically, speak with a forked tongue and have a dual cloak of morality and justice. As to anti-busing, it really means don't force my children to go to your blame inferior schools and stay where you belong. In the South and in many other repressive areas, Negroes have been, in many cases, we have found, convicted of the crime of failing to keep in their place by white judges and juries at the behest of white district attorneys following arrests and beatings by white police. And we believe and we've found that representation is not available since there is abundant evidence that in many areas, both North and South, court-appointed attorneys take little interest in properly defending cases involving blacks. You don't have to go very far to see that happening. Now, the Associated Press underscored this cynicism and frustration when it reported that the efforts of white businessmen to break an economic boycott by blacks in Lee County of Arkansas. There was physical assault on some reporters from Little Rock and several participants in the boycott while passive law enforcement officers stood by. And although white businessmen were armed, no arrest was made by local authorities. It's clear then that the black population, both city and rural, have little faith in the face of things as they are. Thus, in one poll, 40% of black teenagers stated that they felt the only recourse for them was not law, but violence. Now, this cynicism can at least be partially assuaged if we were to provide sufficient, competent black lawyers to make an effective fight in the courts. Now, it's significant to me that the Attica prison riot was that of largely black inmates, sparked not only by the manifest and admitted injustices in the prison, but by the fact that the guards were white, the administrative officials were white, and the black prisoners had no faith in the system which pitted white guards and officials as overseers of black people. As my good friend, Professor Edwards at the University of Michigan Law School says, it is necessary, if the system is to become effective and credible to blacks, that there be black persons visible in all levels of the system. We need such an integrated system of justice. Significantly, there was no real attack on the vicious and degrading system of racial segregation until the late, great Charles Houston and Andy Ransom and determined groups of Negro lawyers undertook the task in the 1930s. One great problem has been that we don't have a sufficient number of black lawyers. Now, this doesn't mean that there have not been, in an earlier period, black lawyers, some who were outstanding, although you won't get this in your history books. All of you have read, of course, of that great black lawyer from New Hampshire who assisted Charles Sumner in that great case, Roberts versus the City of Boston, which was cited in Plessy and Ferguson, which sought to outlaw the segregated school system in Boston in the 1850s. Many of you have heard of the name Langston, but few people, although some of them live on Langston Terrace and go to Langston School, because there are hundreds of them all over, know about John Mercer Langston, who was born on December the 14th, 1829, who went to almost the head of the Northern Underground Railroad, that great school, Oberlin University, and then he did what so many blacks did in the 19th century. After he had graduated from Oberlin College, he went to Oberlin Theological School, although he had about as much interest in theology as I have. But he went there because if you wanted to get a higher education at that time, you told your white friends that you were going to go into theology and they would give you free scholarships. And so he went there. And then, of course, he wanted to go to law school and he couldn't get into a single law school. And so he served apprenticeship and later he served as professor and dean of the Howard University Law School. Later, of course, he was a congressman He was the first president of Virginia State College. And accomplished a great deal in the way of legislation. And then there was Thomas E. Miller, who was born in June the 17th, 1849, who introduced and caused to be passed a bill in South Carolina securing for Negro women in Charleston, South Carolina, the right to teach in the Negro city schools. By the way, this reminds me of something else. You know, when Langston founded Howard University Law School in 1869, he opened it to students of all races. Indeed, Howard University Law School was the first law school, state-supported law school, in the United States to train white women in the law. Now for the kicker. These same white graduates, women graduates, of Howard Law School, once they had started to practice, decided to open another law school in the District of Columbia, in which, in their generosity, they opened to white men and barred all Negroes. And then, of course, there was Edward H. Morris, who was a legislator in Illinois, who introduced the school teachers' pension law and aided in an act which enabled persons who had been married during slavery to inherit. And then there is that great predecessor at the Harvard Law School, the law school, obviously, who graduated from the Harvard Law School in 1869. He was the first black graduate of any law school in the United States. He served in the legislature, and he finally served as judge in the 1880s in the city of Boston. Oh, there's several others that you might like to know about. Before the time of Charlie Houston and the great upsurge, there was Lewis in Boston, the great all-American football player at Harvard, who became one of the premier criminal lawyers in Boston. The only trouble was that Lewis became so high-priced that no Negro could afford him. There was Matthew Bullock, who became another all-American football player from Dartmouth. And I love Dartmouth. It has the most marvelous winter carnivals. And, Matthew Bullock, who was chairman of the parole board in Massachusetts. And then in 1927, there was Raymond Pace Alexander, who formed the first really efficient law firm composed of Negro lawyers in the city of Pennsylvania, and who's now a judge, and whose wife, Sadie Alexander, is one of the most brilliant lawyers in the United States. And then there's my great friend, one of the greatest and most courageous of all lawyers, Z. Alexander Luby of Nashville, Tennessee, who had to have his house guarded day and night because of his courage and his skill in the courts of Nashville. But enough of them. We could talk about them for a long time. The fact is that 1929 was a milestone for the first time, Howard University was transformed from a small evening school to a full-time day school. And it was brought to that school by Mordecai Johnson, Charles Houston. Now, Charles Houston is one of the great men. Charles Houston belonged to a noted family in Washington. He graduated at the top of his class at Harvard Law School. And although he was number one in his class in 1928, no law firm in the United States would hire him. Although at that time, 90% of all Harvard Law School graduates could walk into almost any law firm in the United States. So that Harvard was so disturbed about this that they said, look, stay on with us for another year and we'll keep on trying to get you a job and work for your SJD. And so Charlie stayed at Harvard Law School another year and got his SJD and wrote one of the great papers as a thesis. And they looked around again. They sent out to every law firm practically in the country, and they still couldn't get him a job, not even as a clerk. So then they sent Charles Houston to Madrid to take up civil law, and he spent a year there and got his doctor of civil law and comparative law in Spain, and he still couldn't get a job. And he came back to Washington and started to practice down on F Street. And he was brought up by Mordecai to get him a faculty. And the faculty he assembled at Howard Law School would have done credit to any law school in the United States. There was William Hastie, who later became, as you know, circuit court judge for the Third Circuit and senior judge. He just retired last year with more honors than any American judge other than Frankfurter and Learned Hand has ever gotten. Former governor of the Virgin Islands. And Bill Hastie was hired at Howard Law School. And then there was Andy Ransom. Andy Ransom, a native of Ohio, graduated summa cum laude from Ohio State Law School, went to Harvard, wrote a thesis on non-consensual aspects of suretyship, which I still don't understand. And then Andy tried to get a job at Ohio State, and they explained to him they didn't think he would like living in Columbus again. And he went down to Howard. And then there was what I think is the greatest trial lawyer of criminal cases in these United States, Robert Ming, graduate of the University of Chicago Law School. I love Bob Ming because Bob Ming had a practice of making every student work his self very hard. And he never gave an answer. He made you work it out for yourself. And when Bob Ming got through with you, you knew some law. And you also knew how to think. And when he defended Martin Luther King in Georgia, the lawyers closed up shop to go down and sit in the courtroom to see how law really should be practiced. And Time magazine ran an article about this black lawyer from Chicago that made the judges take lessons. Now, look. One of the prime persons that they, students at Howard at that time, was a brash young fellow with a love for life and all the good things that are incident thereto, with an excellent mind and the ability to sit all night over some refreshments and soak up every argument that anybody could dream about and then present it in the court the next morning better than they could. A fellow by the name of Thurgood Marshall. Now, what happened now was Charlie Houston decided that he would also revitalize the NAACP legal staff. And so between Howard University and the legal staff of the NAACP, you had a focusing point for all the civil rights cases in the United States for a substantial period. Because, why my gosh, as late as 1940, you had one black lawyer in Alabama, Arthur Shores, one black lawyer in Georgia, that's Walton, one black lawyer in South Carolina, Bull Ware, Morgan, I'm afraid, too, I'm sorry. And what happened then was that the NAACP staff and the Howard professors had to cover the United States. And the result was they were the most hardworking people that I know, and definitely the most underpaid. And yet, when you think about this, Howard University during that time provided for almost 90% of all the black lawyers below the Smith and Wesson line, and indeed for almost all those in Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, and other points along the border. And yet, this is just a trickle, because it was not until after 1957 that Howard Law School had more than 100 students. Now, I think we all owe a great debt. But the greatest debt was the assault this small group of dedicated black professionals made upon the institution of segregation in these United States. First of all, let's explain. The black lawyer in the South and in the North was at a whale of a disadvantage. The black people realized that the juries they were about to face were all white, that the judges were all white. At that time, I think there were two black judges in the United States. And that under those circumstances, black people felt that if you wanted to get a semblance of justice, you had to go to a white lawyer. Obviously, the black lawyer did not get any white business, so the result was that he lived on a marginal basis, and he was in a worse social and economic status than the black school teacher, or the post office worker, or the pharmacist. In general, he had less money, he had less status in the community. Now, one of the main things was, what do you do about segregation? What do you do about the professions? You remember I've said that there was, I should have said if I didn't in any event, there wasn't a single professional school in the South which blacks could attend. No social work, no graduate work in the 30s, early 30s. In fact, it was not until 1938 in Gaines Exrel, Canada, that for the first time there was even Jim Crow facilities to which Negroes could attend. Now, I am always asked, why did they work on law schools? And the answer was simple. Charlie Houston's theory was this. Of course, Negroes should be allowed into state professional schools, medicine, social work, graduate work. But he said, look, when you deal with these agencies, you're dealing with what? You're dealing with having to bring in specialists to testify. And the only specialists that white judges are going to listen to in the South are other white specialists. So you've already lost. On the other hand, if you talk about law schools, no bunch of judges ever thinks that any expert knows more about a law school than he does. So you don't have to worry about experts testifying. And so the first case was brought with respect to law schools. That's from Missouri. They set up these separate but equal schools. Southern in Louisiana. North Carolina law school in Durham, 12 miles away from Chapel Hill. A law school in South Carolina at Orangeburg. And by the way, that's one of the most fascinating cases that I've ever seen. They set up this Jim Crow law school. They took them to court. And when they went to court, they screamed they should be allowed into the University of South Carolina law school because of the inferior quality of the Jim Crow law school down in Orangeburg. And the federal judge threw it out on the grounds that it's impossible for any law school to be inferior to the University of South Carolina law school. And then they had the problem of Texas. Now, Texas is fascinating. That sweat and painter, the Mr. Sweat, applied to the University of Texas Law School. And when the legislature heard about that, they said, oh my God, they're going to, dilute the character of the University of Texas. I can't understand how anybody can dilute anything about Texas, but that's another story. In any event, they set up a Jim Crow law school in the basement of the Supreme Court in Austin for 5 law students. And they said you can use the library of the Supreme Court, and to make sure you've got a good faculty, we are assigning the whole faculty of the University of Texas to teach these 5 students. And then when the case went to the Court of Appeals in Texas, the Court of Appeals said, the pupil ratio at this Jim Crow Law School is so marvelous that it's superior to the University of Texas. And then the appeal went to the Supreme Court of the United States, and the Supreme Courts of the United States said, look, and this is a word I want to get across. There can be no equal education in a segregated law school. Think about that. That the only good education, in law at least, is integrated education. Because they said, we don't know what may happen in other places. But one thing we do know, that students in law school learn more from other students than they do from any teacher. And as to that, I say amen. And unless you have all races going to school together, you've shortchanged somebody. Well, now, this, as you know, was a forerunner of all the other decisions. One of the nice things about it is that the persons who brought these cases all through the South, the lawyers that argued in McLaurin, the lawyers that argued in the Supreme Court as a normal outgrowth of this, in the school desegregation cases, every blamed one of those lawyers, except one, was a black lawyer. The one exception was Jack Greenberg, and you know, I still think Black Jack has worked with us so long now that I think he's a blood brother anyway. But now you've got something else. The problem is that you had, of the nearly 300,000 lawyers in America today, less than 4,000 are black. That is, in a free democratic society that prides itself on rule by law, we find an overall white ratio of one lawyer to every 560 white persons. But we note that there's only one black man practicing law for every 4,800 black persons in society. But that's illusory. For although it's 1 to 820 in the District of Columbia, or 1 to 1,500 in Illinois, and even 1 to 2,900 in Michigan, there's 1 to 12,000 in Texas, 1 to 37,000 in Georgia, 1 to 16,000 in North Carolina, 1 to 38,000 in Louisiana, 1 to 40,000 in Alabama, 1 to 75,000 in South Carolina, and my God, you must need a hell of a lot of lawyers in any state from which Strom Thurmond comes. And in Arkansas, out of a black population of 388,000, the latest figure I have is there's only 10 black lawyers. Now, I've said that there were very few black law students in white schools in the North. I was the black law student in my class at Harvard. A fellow by the name of Henry May was the black law student at Yale. But Harvard was much more liberal than Yale because they only had one at a time through all three classes, one every 3 years. While Harvard was pretty nice, there was a senior fellow there when I went there, and so we could say we were, had 100% more than Yale. As far as getting into Columbia, well, you know how it was, and Pennsylvania, and I hate to say this, the University of Illinois had one of the rottenest reputations of any law school in all these United States. As a matter of fact, until 1950, you couldn't stay on the campus, and there were only three places you could eat in town, and you better run over the North End if you wanted a haircut. Matter of fact, There were some other problems. You even had trouble in the Union at that time. Up until 1950. Of course, it was not until that time, of course, that they allowed blacks on the basketball team. And, I don't want to go into that. But we were all very unwelcome here in this university. Now, since that time, what has happened? A great deal has happened. A great deal has gone under the board. One, first thing, since that time, we've had some new deans here. Since that time, there's been a change in attitude. And since that time, too, there's been a great upsurge in attempts by law schools to attract black students. Now, initially, Harvard and Emory in Atlanta started a program to recruit black law students, and they organized a council called CLIO to raise funds for black law students, and received a grant from OEO and $700,000 from the Ford Foundation, $450,000 for 1968, and $250,000 for 1969. And that program has provided scholarships for the many students who have entered law school. Indeed, the number of black students in white law schools now has increased so dramatically that far from Howard University providing 90% of the black lawyers, there are 4,000 black law students in law schools throughout the United States, and 3,000 of those 4,000 are in white law schools. But there's a problem. And the first problem is that private money is no longer available for scholarships. Now, I am also worried. I'm worried about what is happening to the black law students in the southern white schools. Because it seems to me that they are being slowly phased out. Let me tell you a little secret. I just discovered about 2 months ago that there are no black law students anymore at the University of Texas because a great liberal legislature passed laws to provide that you can't have special programs for black students. And for next year, the University of Houston has advised me they, with unlimited money, will no longer have special programs for black students because they have too many white students on the waiting list. Southern Methodist tells me that they have an open door and they'll take all the black law students that you'll send to them up to 7. And Lubbock Tech, which had sent out feelers to all black law schools in the United States, black colleges in the United States, has also informed me that yes, they're still open, although anybody that would go to Lubbock, Texas, ought to go before a sanity board. They will take all up to 5. Now, let me make it clear. Law schools need to go ahead with the integration of blacks in them. Their symbolism the visibility may add a practical dimension of idealism to the school. It'll be both for black, good for black and white students. Now, I've said we've had many more black lawyers now than we had in 1950 or 1960 when the great push began. But if the schools still continue to take as they have in the last 2 years, it would take us until the year 2010 to come to 50% of the proportion to the population of the white lawyers. Now, I've said that we need to do this at every level. And one of the levels you need to work at is with respect to judges. Now, in the judicial game, the most important teams are probably those consisting of judges and practicing lawyers. Among the thousands of judges sitting in the United States, only 269 are black, and most of them are at the magistrate level. And that's practically cheap help. At the state and municipal court level, most of the black judges are sitting in New York, Illinois, Michigan, California, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. This means that in most states in America, there are few, if any, black judges. It's significant, by the way, that there are none in Arkansas, a state in which in 1873 had elected a black judge, Judge Mifflin Gibbs. By the way, when I spoke at the University of Arkansas, they were surprised to learn that they had ever had a black judge in Arkansas. On the federal system, of course, there's Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. There are three judges in the Court of Appeals, Wade McCree in Cincinnati, Spotswood Robinson in the District of Columbia Circuit, and on the district level, there is, of course, a number. Now, the importance of black judges cannot be overemphasized. One, the mere fact that you have a black judge reflects on and influences all the other judges. And by the way, judges have a whale of a lot of discretion. They make the difference between a conviction and a non-conviction. They make the difference between whether bail is there, whether improper evidence gets in or not. And I tell you, if you get before a non-sympathetic judge or an ignorant judge, you have reached, as a lawyer, that place which is hotter than Mississippi. Now, moreover, the judge helps determine whether there's integrated juries. He makes sure that there's proper treatment in his court of all litigants. He, in most cases, checks on and supervises the jail. Judges are important. Now, I've said judges, we've got 26, I think, in Illinois. But you know what the funny thing is? All those judges but two are sitting in Chicago. And those other two are sitting in East St. Louis. I've said we have one lawyer for so many, I think 4,000 something, or 1,500, I forget. Blacks in Illinois, but after you leave the two black lawyers in Peoria, one who practices for the government, you've got one.
there and the two in East St. Louis, and there you are. If you want a black lawyer in this court, you've got to go to Chicago, Gary, East St. Louis, and if you're very lucky, you can go over and if you're not too busy, get the one out of Peoria. That is, the black lawyers, by and large, are only found in the metropolitan areas. Now, speaking of judges, by the by, it's shocking to most of us that the president of these United States has contributed to our cynicism about the course of justice, because he seems in the main to regard a lack of consideration for human dignity and in some cases simple judicial competence as criteria for appointment to the Supreme Court of the United States. I know of no black judge, no black lawyer. There may be some, I don't doubt that they are, that could possibly have been as stupid, incompetent, and inhumane as Carswell. And obviously, the morals of some of the others leave much to be desired. This is not only degrading the Supreme Court of the United States, but is demeaning to the judicial system and is the deliberate insult to the people of the United States. He has just given out a call for interference with the judiciary who are solely trying to desegregate by saying he's going to have the Department of Justice interfere with school desegregation orders. That is, let me emphasize, it's bothersome to some of us that recent appointments have done nothing to aid the cause of equality, human dignity, or even simple justice. There was a recent Berger decision taking away one of the tools of effective representation to alleviate injustice by barring, or at least delaying, federal remedies against vicious police harassment and punishment of minority law-abiding citizens who have done nothing to be punished for. And Berger says, in the interest of states' rights, we are going to let the state courts in Mississippi, South Carolina, Georgia, and Alabama do with you as it will until it takes you 2 years to come up to the Supreme Court. And I said this was done in the name of states' rights, and states' rights, in most instances, is a code name for permitting states to deal unjustly with this darker system. Well, also, the number is tremendous. All the cases that came up. The juvenile laws need effective change, and the old Warren Court was about to do something about it. And I am convinced, as is most of my compatriots, that the reason this Berger Court has not done anything about making the juvenile court laws unjust is because many, or a disproportionate number, of juveniles coming before juvenile court are blacks. Well, what do we need to do for lawyers? We need to get lawyers. To get lawyers, we need more state schools who are giving scholarships. We need scholarships if we are to save our equal opportunity program at this university. I've never done so publicly, and I will do so now. I want to commend Dean Cribbett of the University of Illinois Law School and Professor Goldberg, and though especially, and for those members of the legislature of Illinois who attempted to help when we went to them to get state monies for this. I have less than praise for those who, while mouthing support of athletics, refused on the ground that their party did not like it, defeated attempts to provide help for the law school program on the ground of party loyalty. I hope that the voters of this state will look up those gentlemen, some of whom were from Champaign, and make sure that we have more decent and fair representation in the legislature. One thing I want to make clear, we don't need inferior lawyers. We need competent, skilled lawyers. We don't need paraprofessionals. We need social engineers. No intelligent black wants a lowering of standards. We want an opportunity and not shoddy workmanship.